I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. There's a fascinating new book out that I'm looking forward to finishing. So far, it's quite interesting and timely. We live in an era where we're seeing a lot of well-known figures, celebrities, billionaires, and former politicians going out there giving large and encouraging us to do so. Lawrence Scanlon recently spent a year spending a month at 12 different charitable organizations looking at what's going on at the front lines. We meet the players, get a sense of the politics around charitable and philanthropic endeavor, and see some of the people who are the recipients of such generosity. The book is called A Year of Giving Generously, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Philanthropy. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Lawrence Scanlon is the winner of 3 National Magazine Awards and the best-selling author or co-author of 13 books on various subjects. He lives in Kingston but joins me from Toronto this day. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Lawrence Scanlon. Good morning, Mr. Scanlon.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Very well, yourself.
I'm good.
When did this all happen, this year that you spent at these 12 different charities?
The book has its genesis with the death of my mother in 2003. I'm the eldest of a very large family. I have 7 siblings. And my mother was a pediatric and then a geriatric nurse, and we wanted to do something to honor her memory. We finally settled on a nursing scholarship at the University of Toronto, and it's a self-sustaining scholarship, and we felt pretty good about it. The gift, though, paled beside that of a man named Bloomberg. I think he made his fortune in mining. He gave $10 million to the same School of Nursing, and they ended up naming the School of Nursing after him. So I began to think about, and because I'm of a certain age, I'm 62 years old, I was younger then, back in 2003, and I began to wonder about the mark we make in the world. Why is it that these rich people were, I kept reading the word, someone would die and their obituary would be in the Globe and Mail, and at the end of it would say, Joe Blow, industrialist, art collector, philanthropist. Almost always, the word philanthropist was there. So it was like there was a charity Olympics underway, and I guess the winner of the big gold medal would be Bill Gates, with Warren Buffett getting a silver. They have created the largest charitable foundation the world has ever seen. Last time I looked, it was worth about $60 billion. Part of it, I think, is that these deep-pocketed people think that they know better, and sometimes they do. They know better than governments and others how to fix some of the problems of the world. Now, in the case of Bill Gates, he's decided to tackle malaria, and he's doing great work with malaria. But there are some problems with that model of philanthropy, and we can get into them later, but what I discovered was just how complicated it is, but the investigation starts with me deciding to head out on a journey, doing 12 charitable gigs over the course of 12 months, and then writing about what I saw and what I experienced and the people I met and the stories I gathered.
And there are well-known charities, there are lesser-known charities, there are local ones in Kingston where you live.
Yeah.
And some in Toronto, and then some elsewhere in other countries, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you choose the charities that you went to?
I hope I chose carefully. Some people didn't want me, frankly. Not all charities want a reporter snooping around. I tried to make it clear that I wasn't intending to write an expose. So, but some people, I remember there was a horse camp, a very celebrated horse camp. I wanted to go and volunteer. I'm a horsey guy. I've got a horse, and I've written a lot about horses. But the camp basically said, number one, we don't need the publicity, and number two, we don't want you hanging around here taking notes. There may have been privacy issues. Another very high-profile charity said no to me. I'd rather not name them, but they said no, and maybe for the same reason. So, but the 12 charities or NGOs all mean something personally to me. I chose an environmental group, Lake Ontario Waterkeeper, because I consider myself someone interested in environmental matters. I chose a soup kitchen, Drop-In Center Vinnie's, because I've long been interested in the poor. I chose Canadian Crossroads International and their work supporting a women's radio station in Dakar, Senegal, because I love radio, and I think radio is a great tool for social change, and so does Canadian Crossroads International. I chose New Orleans because I have an interest in Habitat for Humanity, and I'm just interested in New Orleans. I chose Central America because I've long, for 20 years, I've been a volunteer with Horizons of Friendship, based in Cobourg, Ontario, and they do great work with their partners in Central America. So each one of these month-long endeavors reflected some sort of personal interest or passion of mine.
And so for the month, would you be there Monday to Friday, say, or?
Sometimes I was. One of the lighter duties was when I volunteered at a place called Onguinada. This is a day program, quite a substantial one, for people who are profoundly challenged. They are non-verbal. They communicate in very subtle ways, and they have a pet therapy program. So I brought my dog, Dusty, around to these people, and the aim was to interact with them, to brighten their days, to just get them interested, to provoke some sort of response from them. And at the beginning, we weren't. And I only went in, I think it was 2 days a week for a few hours, for about a month. So that was lightweight duty. On the other hand, my stint in Senegal was very intense. It was 6 days a week for 4 weeks. I would teach radio journalism one day, and my wife would teach English the next. So that was, and I was also, by the way, teaching in French. And that was a challenge for me, as I'm sure it was for the people who had to listen to me. I do speak a kind of French. I studied in university. It's not very good, but it's passable, I guess. And so part of my preparation for that stint was to brush up on my university French. So some of them were quite involving, and some of them were, but they were all engaging. I mean, not one of them was, oh dear, that was a miserable one, or that wasn't any fun, or I didn't learn anything there. Far from that. I really think that I learned a lot from each one, and I had fun at each one. I had fun playing euchre with dying people. I never thought that would happen. They were very straight-ahead people, and we did find things to laugh at. I mean, there's sadness, too. I mean, some of the people I played euchre with are no longer around. Some of the people I worked with in Central America are very sick now. They're not doing very well. Some are doing very, very well. So that's just part of the territory.
And heretofore, prior to all this, I mean, had you given much of your time, your money, to various charities and the sort?
Yeah, I grew up in Scarborough, Ontario. It's a suburb of Toronto. And in those days, there was a very strong sense of neighborhood. My father ran the church baseball league and the softball league, and we played sports. When I was in university, I headed up the cystic fibrosis campaign for 2 years running. I coached my son's hockey and baseball teams. So I was a volunteer, but probably no more, no less than any of people in my circle. But this book was, I had to come up with a structure that would allow me to explore the subject of generosity from the point of view. If you'll notice, Joe, on the cover, there are hands. There's a hand at the top, and there's a hand at the bottom, and the one is giving, and the one is receiving. And my task was to explore both sides of that exchange, who gives and why, and who must put out their hands and why. So I didn't know this, but I would end up looking at structural inequality. You know, why is it that some people are just chronically poor? And I hope I have some answers for that at the end of the book.
Which hand is giving and which one's receiving? That's a question.
Yeah. My sense is that the one at the top is the one that's giving, and the one at the bottom, because he's got his, his palm out. So I think the one at the bottom is the one who's receiving.
Yeah. What is philanthropy? Is that giving money, or is that also time?
It's both. We tend to think of philanthropists as very rich people giving money, and typically at the end of their lives. But really the word comes from, not that I speak Greek, but I know the Greek word philanthropia, which means love of your fellow human. So that it's time or money, some sort of service to others. It could be called humanitarianism or beneficence or kindness or generosity. Any of those words, social justice, any of those words would apply.
And because of the recession, are we seeing less of it?
I'm afraid we are. I hope we're heading out of the recession. But yeah, charities, what's happening is that charities are really struggling to maintain their funding. Governments will cut back. Whenever there's a cutback, you know that the people who are going to suffer most are, one, those who run charities and those who benefit from charities. So governments are very proud when election times come around. They're very proud of saying that, we're holding to the tight ship here. There'll be no tax increases. And the truth is that some of those tax dollars are wasted. And there are countries in the world where people pay more taxes than we do. And in fact, those people are better off and they're happier. And those people tend to be, study after study has shown, those people tend to be the Scandinavians.
And what are they doing that we ought to emulate? I mean, higher taxes, is that what you're calling for?
I'm calling, if not for higher taxes, then for a wiser use of those taxes. I don't support the war in Afghanistan. I don't support a lot of the corporate bailouts that have been happening. Governments will say that the cupboards are bare, but suddenly they're not bare when they perceive a need or when the lobbyists get to them. There aren't very few lobbyists for the poor. Almost no one speaks for the poor. So I guess what I'm saying, if we were to pay, for example, what the Danes pay, and they pay 60% taxes, and it's a progressive tax, so the more money you make, the more you end up giving. Now that assumes, and that's a smart move, I would say, if the money is used wisely. So that's a big if, maybe. But in study after study, when people were surveyed, Western countries were surveyed, where are people the happiest? Where are the lowest rates of neonatal death rate? Where is the lowest level of illiteracy? Where's the lowest level of incarceration, levels of violence, basic human health and happiness? Where is it the greatest? And it tended to always to be in these studies, and I looked at a lot of them, they tended to be in Scandinavian countries. So our misfortune, as I see it, is to live next door to the U.S. of A. I have many great American friends, but I just don't buy what they're doing, this Tea Party phenomenon where people are saying we shouldn't pay any taxes. Is so far at the other end of the spectrum of what they're doing in countries like Norway and Sweden that it's laughable. So, yeah, my conclusion is we may have to pay higher taxes, but I think we'll be better off in the long run.
You mentioned earlier, you mentioned Gates and Buffett, and you said that the model of sort of this big money philanthropy is the wrong model. Is it because it discourages the rest of us from donating, say?
I think it does. I don't have no proof of that, but that's my hunch. Every time a gift in the millions and billions is made, that gift tends to make the front pages. And I can't help but think that ordinary people think, well, I don't have to bother because Bill Gates is on the job. But the other problem, and it may be more serious, is that when you have somebody like Bill Gates with his millions and billions, he gets to call the shots. Now, he's decided that malaria and to a lesser extent HIV/AIDS are going to be his targets, and he's trying to come up with a malaria vaccine, which may be the best way of dealing with malaria in the world, which is a serious scourge. When I was in Africa, many, many people just knew that they were going to get sick every spring because of mosquitoes carrying malaria. But there are a lot of problems with that approach. One is, how do you keep malaria vaccine refrigerated in countries where, when we were in Dakar, the power went out every week, two and three times a week? How do you get the vaccine to remote locations where sometimes there are no roads? How do you deliver the vaccine? Who's going to deliver it? And what happens if Bill Gates wakes up tomorrow and says, you know what, this malaria thing just isn't working for me. I think I'm going to go on to something else. And there's no one to say, Bill, sorry, you made promises. There's a whole superstructure built around your promises and your aid. So there are problems with government-to-government aid, and there are problems with bureaucracies, but having rich people who have made a great success in the corporate world, putting them in charge of issues of civil society, I don't think that that's always the best way to go.
Do you have an idea about Canadians' as habits in terms of donating, whether it's financially or time-wise? Do you have a sense of whether it's done locally or globally?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers on where the money is going. I only know that as a percentage of their income, the poor give more than the rich. I also know that something like, these are StatsCan figures, 75% of Canadians who make $80,000 or more a year give nothing to charity. I know that charities are having a really hard time keeping board members, that volunteers are getting stretched thin. They're getting worn out by staffing food banks and shelters. Many of these mechanisms were set up as stopgap measures back in the late 80s, early 90s, and they have continued. In fact, they're growing. There are more and more soup kitchens. In my community, Kingston, there's a huge patchwork of shelters and soup kitchens and drop-ins, and people on the street, people who live in shelters, know what's available, but they're made into gypsies. They simply must go from this place to the next place. The number one problem that assails poor people in this country, as far as I can tell, is shelter. They live in shelters where their stuff is stolen, where they are sometimes assaulted. They're not always treated kindly. And the soup kitchens are open. One might be open on a Monday. One is open on a Tuesday. So in a city like Toronto, you are just navigating the system all the time. Every single day is a crisis. So my position is that if we have enough money to fight a war, I don't think we belong in Afghanistan, but that's just me. If we have money for that, if we have money for bailouts, why don't we have money for poor people? People who are, and by the way, those poor people are very much like us. I met so many people who were, even 2 years ago, were working, they had very good lives, and then the dominoes begin to fall. You get a divorce, your house catches fire and you don't have insurance. You lose a job, there's illness, yours or somebody close to you. It doesn't take too much. Some people live very close to the edge right now. All it takes is one domino. But so many people I talk to, it's 12 dominoes. So I really feel, I mean, at the end of the book, I think I was a more sympathetic person. I hope I am. But I'm also a more angry person. I'm really kind of fed up that these people have to live in the way that they do.
Now, in terms of bridging the gap between the rich and the poor, do you have an idea whether that's giving locally or giving globally?
No, I think you should do both. I certainly, in this book, worked and volunteered locally as well as far afield. I think it's the same impulse. I do have to say, though, that in Costa Rica, especially in Costa Rica, I saw poverty that far outstripped anything I saw here. That said, we do have third world conditions right here. So I hope it's not an either or. I think one should give where one's heart takes one. And I don't have a magic prescription for saying you should, 10% abroad and 90% here or 50-50. I think you go where the heart is. And part of what I did was to simply go where my heart took me and just see what I saw. It was a process of education. So I think I'll go back to Africa. I know I'll go back to Central America. I'll probably go back to New Orleans. So I just went where I thought I belonged.
The other thing that I've been concerned about in recent weeks is because it's tax time. Taxes are due, I guess, later this week. Mm-hmm. Donation dollars that are going to administration, does that concern you when you're giving money? Say, or should that concern you when
Absolutely.
You're giving money? That how much is going to administration as opposed to what's going to the ground?
Absolutely. When we were in Costa Rica, we met a very young American woman and a young British man, and they were in their gap years between high school and the next phase. And they loved the work that they did. They were teaching English in a village called Coweta on the coast. and people clearly loved them. We talked to the woman on the street, and she kept being stopped every 5 seconds by somebody who wanted to say hello to her in English. But both of these people had very nasty things to say about the particular NGO that organized their staying with the host family in Costa Rica. And they were angry because they knew how much money they paid the organization to facilitate this trip, and they knew how much the host family was getting. So as far as they could see, the host family was getting ripped off. So, yeah, there are so-called charities out there, which really are scams. They're make-work projects for people. So you really have to, call ahead, get references, talk to people. You know, if a way of avoiding that situation in Costa Rica would have been for those two people to insist on talking to people who had gone before them. And they would have quickly found out that, you know, it is maybe not a scam, maybe that's too harsh, but certainly the local people weren't too impressed. They loved to have these people as guests, but they weren't getting very much money to pay for their food and shelter.
A philosophical question, if you'll permit. There's an excerpt of the book in the Globe and Mail recently, mm-hmm. and the gist of that was that if we are generous, the happier we'll be. Isn't seeking happiness inherently selfish?
Yeah, I've had this discussion with my son, who's a psychology major at Guelph. Yeah, that may well be, but I guess my response is, so what? If the act of serving others brings you happiness, does that really matter? You've still achieved what you set out to do. And what I discover, you know, the question is it good to be good? I think from a scientific point of view, absolutely. They took a group of people and they simply asked them to look on film of Mother Teresa doing her good works. And those people at the end of the film felt better about humanity and their own humanity and generosity than they did at the beginning. So it's called helper's high. It's a kind of physiological response to kindness that we feel. And I understand the question. Yeah, it may well be selfish. And maybe I'm a selfish guy for being generous for a year, but I guess I don't see it that way. I think that we should just think more about this. Think more about kindness. June Colwood, the great social activist, said the same thing as an ex-priest told us when we were in Costa Rica. Both said, "Our advice to you is to make contact with the poor. Do not just drop a loony in the cup. Spend some time with them. Get to know them. What they really crave more than anything is your respect, is some dignity, because they're denied it on a day-to-day basis. So if my spending time with somebody, just a few minutes with somebody who is begging on the street, if that makes him feel better and makes me feel better, well, I'm happy with that equation."
Lawrence, this is such an important book. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
All right, Joe. Appreciate it.
You're very
Thanks
welcome.
For your time and interest.
You're very welcome. The book
okay.
is called A Year of Giving Generously, Dispatches from the Frontline of Philanthropy. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Lawrence Scanlon, on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planto.